on. I don't know if you need this. Yeah. So it's a pleasure to be back and, at ITP, and as Leon commented, I really, my first time was here was about 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago, and I still have lots of fond memories, as well as lots of continuing collaborations that are going on with people who were here 4 years ago at this workshop. And so, you know, the ITP is doing its job, and it's stimulating a lot of hopefully good research, some of which I'm going to tell you about today. Okay, so I'm going to talk about elasticity and fluctuations in phase transitions in membranes. And most of the work I'm going to talk about was in collaboration with John Toner, who was also a visitor here for one of the workshops, and our proximity due to ITP and some lounging on the beach stimulated some of this work. Okay, so what am I going to really talk about before even the outline, sort of pre-introduction, is, you know, just to give you an idea what kind of objects I'm going to be trying to describe. Okay, so that is, I'm going to talk about membranes, and first let me sort of go over some physical realization of membranes. So they occur both in laboratory and in nature, that is biology. So probably the best, most familiar example of biology of a membrane is maybe red blood cells, which is this bilayer of phospholipid molecules, which are made up of a polar head and sort of a fatty tail. So the polar head wants to be exposed to water, and the fatty tail doesn't like water. And because of that, that leads to the cephalosembal structure in which the heads are exposed to the aqueous solution, and the tails are sort of hidden inside this bilayer. Okay, in the red blood cell, nature does it for you, and in addition to give this red blood cell some rigidity, that is, if after it squeezes through fine capillaries, it can spring back to its normal shape, there's also actually a sort of a tethered two-dimensional polymeric network that creates a backbone that sits on top of this lipid bilayer and gives it its rigidity, okay, sort of like a two-dimensional polymeric network. So this is sort of a biological example. In laboratory, these things are seen all the time. If you take a bunch of these lipids, the whole range of type of lipids, and put them in solution, they self-organize into these bilayers. And again, the reason they want to do that is for electrostatic reasons. They basically want to screen out the fatty tails that don't like water, so they look for other lipids to combine with to form these bilayers. So depending on the concentration of ions in the solution, temperature, they form different topological objects. Sometimes they form these liposomes. Sometimes they form tubules. Sometimes they form these lamellar-like structures, symmetric-like structures. Probably, again, one of the most familiar examples of this is basically soap. You know, the way the soap works from this point of view is that, you know, you have some maybe oil on your hands, and the way to wash off with water this oil is to basically, normally oil and water do not mix, but if you add some of these lipids, surfactant molecules, then they sit on the interface between oil and water, and they decrease the surface tension between oil and water and allow better mixing between oil or the dirt on your hands and the water that uses to wash it off. Okay, there are lots of sort of futuristic applications of these things, such as this liposome could be either an artificial red blood cell, and there are efforts along these lines that NRL in Washington. So this would be your sort of a synthetic imitation of this red blood cell. There's also, you know, perfume industries are quite interested in these kind of systems because, you know, you can enclose perfume inside this thing and have the perfume leak out from this vesicle slowly through the sort of the porous medium, leak out slowly over long time scales rather than sort of you apply perfume and then it goes away very quickly. Also for drug deliveries, you can encapsulate some medicine and deliver it precisely to some part of your body. Or and then have the vesicle maybe disintegrate and now you have a more precise delivery of medicine. There's even more futuristic examples where you can use these self-assembled structures as sort of like a scaffolding for building microtubules where, for example, you create something like this that's basically liquid-like, and then at NRL, they've been able to coat these objects with metal. And then what they do is they wash away the tubule, the lipids, the fat. And now you have this really high, incredibly high aspect ratio that's basically only microns in this direction, maybe millimeters in this direction, fine microtubules that are metal-like. Okay, and so there's, the applications of these objects would be, enormous. For example, for microsurgery, and there's some other pretty interesting things, again, for encapsulation. Say it again?
You coat
the thing with metal. So the lipid sort of provides it like a scaffolding, which, allows the metal to form this nice rigid tubule. And then you wash away the lipid. And now you have these nice structures. Okay, so that's sort of the motivation, but that's not really the object I'm going to talk about. There's a whole industry of statistical mechanics trying to understand topological phase transitions between these phases, focusing on one of the phases and understanding fluctuations in them. What I really wanted to talk about is polymerized membranes, which are quite a bit different. And so I really need to stress this distinction. That is, all the objects that I talked about in the previous transparency, aside from the cytoskeleton of the red blood cell, were go under the name of liquid membranes. And what I mean by liquid membranes is that the lipids on the surface of a membrane is a two-dimensional liquid. That is, the molecules are not tied to each other and they can move around the surface. There's no shear modulus associated with the order in the membrane. There's no order. Okay, so that's what I call 2D liquid, so the shear modulus is zero, there's no connectivity. However, the objects I'm going to be describing, the focus of this talk is polymerized objects, where I take and interconnect all these little lipids by infinitely strong bonds. And one way to do that is to use lipids that you can polymerize. So thereby you create a two-dimensional network, polymeric network. And you can think of this as some generalization of two-dimensional generalization of a polymer. Okay, polymer chain. And so then one can ask, very much like you, in the old days, people have worried about what is the fluctuation properties of a polymer, how big is it, what is its statistics, this random walk statistics. Now I'm asking about random walk statistics of a bigger dimensional object. And for technical reasons, and maybe to be a little bit general, I'm going to talk about a d-dimensional elastic manifold. D-dimensional, physically it's 2, embedded in n dimensions. So n physically is 3, and D is 2. Okay? So this is the kind of object I need to focus on, and the main distinction you have to keep in mind is that this thing has shear elasticity and connectivity, and that's very important. That is, there are modes in this system that do not exist in this system. So the goal is a description of these objects and phases and phase transitions that can arise in this system. Okay? So I've already gone over the introduction. So what are the phases I'm going to talk about? It turns out that in these polymerized membranes, why they're so interesting from a theoretical point of view, is that they exhibit not a single crumpled phase, but also exhibit intermediate phases, structural phases. And now I will explain what that means as the talk goes on. I will describe a model of these phases, what model produces these phases in mean field theory. Then I'll talk about a little bit about thermal fluctuations, how to include thermal fluctuations, and what the difficulties with that is. That is, for example, stability of these transitions in these phases to thermal fluctuations, and what neat physics arises within these phases. And then I'll discuss some related problems and conclude. We started about 10 minutes late, so I hope... Okay, so let me give you a feeling for what model I might describe this polymerized membrane. Okay, so what I didn't mention, maybe it's important to put back up, is that one property, important property of this thing is one is the shear elasticity, which I did mention. But the other property is that these membranes are rigid in a sense that they have bending rigidity, in the sense that think of them made up of little rods. And these rods like to align with themselves simply because they don't like water getting inside and getting close to the fatty tails. So because of that, the rods would like to align. So you can think of if you think of a lattice model, there's a normal-normal interaction in this membrane. Okay, so there's a little normal sitting in the membrane, and the normals would like to align. So let me start out with sort of a very hands-on kind of a lattice model that describes this membrane. There's basically a bunch of particles. They're tethered together, so there's some elasticity. And then there's some normal-normal interaction that tries to align and make the membrane flat. Okay, so if you minimize the energy of this membrane, it's going to be flat. And the question is, what happens if you include fluctuations? Okay, So we want a Landau continuum description of this because it's, you know, on the computer this is a fine model, but if you want to have some analytics, it's nicer to work with continuum field theories. So let's construct, sort of following the works of Landau in the same spirit, let's try to construct the Landau theory of this. So what first we need to identify, okay, so first let me tell you the notation. X alpha is going to determine the coordinates that live in the membrane, and R of X alpha tells me where the point in the membrane lives in the embedding space, n-dimensional space. So that what are the degree, what are the symmetries that we identify? Well, first there's a rotational invariance in the embedding space. And there's also a translational invariance in the embedding space. Also, there's a rotational and translational invariance in the internal space. And so therefore, that is basically, based on these symmetries, you can convince yourself that the order parameter for this thing is not R of X alpha, but it actually has to be a tangent vector to the R, simply because, you know, the coordinate R itself has no meaning. You can put the membrane in. So therefore, the theory that you construct, F of R, your action or your effective free energy, is basically a power expansion in this T of alpha. So it's very simple. Think of phi-4 theory, O-N model, or something like this. This is sort of like the phi, you know, the vector field. And so now this is the second power of T. This is a fourth power of T. And then there's some gradient term of T. So this gradient term is a continuum description of the curvature term. And then this thing is basically like elasticity. And then, of course, there's other things that come in, which are sort of non-local terms. This is bending rigidity. This is elasticity. But then there's also something that's pretty difficult to treat and you often don't find in standard field theories, but we know it from polymer physics. There's a self-avoiding interaction, which says that, you know, this point, if it comes close to a very distant point on the membrane, like, let's say, this point and this point, they could be very far away. If they come close together in the embedding space, that costs some energy V. And so I certainly need to put in terms like this, and they might be important or not important depending on what phase I look at. So let me just, to drive this home, probably it's already clear, but I'm not, just to make sure everybody's with me. Again, the order parameter is a tangent vector, so I'm sort of dropping, it's very schematic, I'm not keeping track of any indices, really these are two-index objects. Tau is some reduced temperature or bending rigidity. You can think of it as a reduced temperature or parameter that controls the transition. So then immediately with this analogy, if you just look at the mean field theory of an isotropic membrane, you immediately conclude there's a phase transition. That is, there's a phase transition from a crumpled state where the potential is like this when tau is positive, where the average tangent is zero, and the average tangent is zero is basically describes that the membrane is crumpled. Okay, there's a phase transition to a state which is flat, where the normal sort of aligned, there's non-zero excitation value of the tangent. Okay, and so this is what I'll be calling a crumple in the flat phase. Okay, so that's, you know, it's fairly simple, and it basically is built on, you know, at least a mean field theory on the analogy with magnetic systems. And so the question is, so what? I mean, what is this, how much of this does survive in the presence of fluctuations? And naively, you would say none of it survives because we know in magnetic systems in two dimensions, such orders cannot exist. You cannot break continuous symmetries. And so the part of the object of my talk will be to convince you that's not true for polymerized membranes. So let me look a little bit closer at what these phases are like. You know, what are the problems? What kind of things I'd like to calculate? So certainly the crumpled phase exists because, you know, if the temperature is high enough, it prefers disordered phases. It wins over the energy, and so the system crumples. That's sort of the analog of a paramagnetic state in the magnet, if you think of the normals as the little spins. So the thing that's most important in the crumpled state is to try to calculate the size of this object. That's sort of the analog of the polymer size. That's the radius of gyration, and that will grow at some power of the internal dimension of the membrane. If this dimension, if I stretch it out, is L, and then I let it go and have it randomly walk around, I could ask how big is this object. That's what I call radius of gyration. That's an important concept that I'll come to over and over again. So the theory that describes this is basically in the crumpled state is something like this. There's some term that's just the derivative of R. This is sort of like you can think of it as a surface tension term, this is just sort of a generalization. This is basically a generalization to D dimensions over a random walk. non-self-intersecting random walk. Here's this object walking around a random space, in space, n-dimensional space, but this object is not one-dimensional anymore, it's d-dimensional. And so I'm trying to calculate how big it is. And so some of the things, so one property is, the main property that characterizes this exponent nu, you can show that it's a fractal object, you can try to compute this nu, there are various techniques, field theory techniques to compute, you can do a renormalization group. I didn't mention, what is the nonlinearity? The nonlinearity is this self-intersection nonlinearity, the self-avoiding interaction. And so the question is to try to perturb this Gaussian theory in terms of this, this self-avoiding interaction. There are various techniques of doing it. One of the sort of fairly accurate approximate method is the Flory theory, and it predicts nu to be such an expression. Yeah. That's right. This is just represent more physically way of writing this. It just says that there is a density-density interaction between the monomers. You know, if you just go and write out what this density is by putting in what it is in terms of particles, you'll get this. Right. It's sort of like, think of this as a summation of all the particles in one density and the other density, and they interact by short range. This delta function shouldn't be thought too seriously. It's really in quotes. There's some short-range interaction. But if I look at longer scales, that short-range interaction renormalizes to a delta function, and so I might as well look at these delta function interactions. So there's some maybe special cases. So liquid membranes and polymers, that is linear polymer chains, always crumple. Asymptotically, they will always crumple, and that's sort of consistent with what we believe in the analogy with magnetic systems, that, you know, in two dimensions, in the liquid membranes, or in one-dimensional polymers, there's no spontaneous breaking of continuous symmetry. And this, of course, occurs only beyond when the system size is bigger than some persistent length. Of course, there will be flat over some scale, but the statement is in the thermodynamic limit, they will crumple. Okay? And actually, in physical systems, these persistent lengths can be quite large. And so that's why some of the things I'm going to talk about physically, are tough to measure experimentally, just because these persistent lengths might be quite large. And if they're large, all the physics I'm talking about is beyond this length scale. So I said that for liquid membranes, consistent with your expectations, there's nothing interesting goes on. It's always crumpled, just like for linear polymers. And the point is, the main point on the upshot of sort of last 10 years of research on polymerized membranes is that, and sort of what got people excited about is that in polymerized membranes, there's actually fluctuations in the flat phase actually stabilize the flat phase in two dimensions. And so let me now I've described that I have this flat phase, and now let me try to ask whether the fluctuations destabilize it or not. That's sort of the standard way you try to prove that the phase is stable. So a completely flat phase is described by a vector r, which is x comma y comma equals z comma 0. And now there are going to be three modes that describe fluctuations. There are going to be high fluctuations, which tell you the fluctuations out of plane. There's going to be four non-fluctuations, ux and ui. So that is the general position of a membrane is x plus ux, y plus ui, plus some height undulation. Okay. So if you write down, from the theory that I wrote down, from the Landau theory I wrote down, I can now describe this fluctuating flat phase, which will have some bending rigidity and some elasticity. So this elasticity is very simple. This is the thing that you can look up in Landau-Lipschitz theory of elasticity. And this is an additional term that allows the membrane, describes the physics of a membrane undulating in the, out of plane. The strain tensor, sort of geometrically, you can think of it as the preferred metric of a fluctuating membrane minus the preferred flat metric. So one way to show that this theory is very non-trivial and actually and the flat phase is actually stable, is one thing you can do is actually integrate phonons that these degrees of freedom out exactly. And what you get is a theory that looks like this. This is a little bit schematic, but basically you get something like this. That is, you have some quadratic term, which is just this, plus a quartic interaction. There's some interpretation of this term in terms of long-range interaction between local Gaussian curvatures. And those local Gaussian curvatures are interacting via phonon propagation, which has this kind of a vertex. Okay? Notice the coefficient here is the shear modulus. So in polymers and liquids, this term would be zero, and so therefore there would not be any effect. And what I'm going to claim is that this term, one way to see that there's something new that goes on with polymerized membranes, is that that term has interesting effects. You can study this nonlinearity in perturbation theory, and you find that perturbation theory diverges. So you can use methods of renormalization group, but the upshot of these methods is that what they find is can be summarized in terms of a phase diagram. So here's the phase transition that I described before. And so I'm not focusing on this phase right now. That's the phase transition. I'm not focusing on this point right now. That's the point that separates the crumple phase from a flat phase. What I'm actually asking about is I'm sitting here in a flat phase at low temperatures, and now I ask, what are the fluctuations like? And I'm asking whether that phase is stable. And what you find is that because of this nonlinearity, this phase is actually stabilized, but it's stabilized not by a Gaussian fixed point, sort of a trivial fixed point where this thing flows to zero, but it's stabilized by a non-trivial fixed point describing a whole... first of all, this fixed point is non-trivial, and it describes the whole low-temperature phase, the flat phase. It describes fluctuations in this low-temperature phase. There's a number of people that have studied this phase. For field theorists, this is actually a very interesting system, because if you sort of think about other systems, you know, this is... I can't, off the top of my head, I can't think of any other system that does this. Usually when you break the symmetry, you have some Goldstone modes that describe your low-temperature phase, but usually the theory of those Goldstone modes is trivial, at least as far as I know. For example, XY model is just a simple Gaussian fixed point describes it. If you take something more complicated like nonlinear sigma model, let's say ON model, that is usually just unstable and flows off to... strong coupling, and we interpret that as a disorder phase. Here you actually describe the Goldstone modes themselves, are interacting and described by a non-trivial fixed point. At this fixed point, there are lots of interesting properties, but one way to characterize them is in terms of these correlators. But physically, one thing that comes out of this fixed point is that the roughness of the membrane you can calculate. How rough is it? You know, it's fluctuating. You can ask, how big is the fluctuation for a membrane of size L? So you can compute this exponent, and it's approximately 0.59. The other two interesting things that come out about the flat phase is that the elastic moduli, this kappa and this mu, actually end up being length scale dependent. They're not constants any longer, but they're length scale dependent in this way, that the kappa actually diverges with length scale. So the bending rigidity of this membrane becomes larger and larger if you take bigger and bigger membrane. And the shear modulus actually becomes weaker and weaker if you take bigger and bigger membrane. One other thing about this flat phase is that...
So does that mean it flows to a non-impacting theory?
No, it doesn't mean that. It does not.
Right.
Say it again?
The quartic term.
No, it just means that one way to think of it is that this is a constant, but this power has changed. Not this power, but the derivative. There's not four derivatives here, but 4 minus eta u. Okay, it becomes non-analytic. Okay, so before I return to these issues, what this really means physically, and I do want to describe that, that's sort of the most exciting part of it, is I want to explain to you how is it that given these properties, if you give me these properties of the membrane, and these exponents are related, so there's only one independent exponent, eta. Given the properties that there's non-trivial eta, how is it that this flat phase is stable? How does it sort of beat Mermer-Wagner theorem? And so the way it does it is, suppose I ask, what is the variance of the angle fluctuations that the normal makes with the z direction? So normally you calculate this. This is sort of like the spin-spin fluctuations in the magnetic system. It's proportional to KBT, and it's some integral cut off by the size of the system over the wave vectors over all the modes, which is 1 over the stiffness, which is 1 over Q squared times kappa, where kappa is the bending rigidity. And what you find is if kappa is a constant, the order is gone as long if you're below two dimensions, because this thing diverges. So that means I can take a system, if I take a system large enough, this theta will be bigger than 2 pi, and therefore the membrane has curved on itself, the hemolysis breaks down, and I interpret that as a crumpled state. That's the standard Mermer-Wagner analysis. However, what's interesting here is that once kappa is renormalized, it's sitting at this natural fixed point, then cap is actually grows with length scale in such a way that this 2 is actually, you know, is reduced because of this kappa. And so because of that, this theta square variance fluctuation actually goes to 0 with some exponent, the same exponent eta. And so therefore, the flat face is stable. And this is a beautiful example of order from disorder. Thermal fluctuations are sort of trying to roughen the membrane and make it fluctuate. On the other hand, as they do that, they're creating ripples in the membrane, and those ripples actually as the membrane fluctuates, it creates a very stiff kappa, which itself prevents the membrane from crumpling, prevents the from Neumann-Ragnow theorem working, and that balance is just achieved at this critical at this fixed point. And so this whole phase is actually very interesting. This whole phase is a critical state. Okay, there's a non-trivial Goldstone modes.
Is that mu at the top? Is that the same as the shear modulus originally?
That's the original shear modulus. That's right, times some factors. But basically, it's
the force. Are you assuming that mu is small in some sense compared to kappa originally?
What really, yeah. So what really enters there is mu over.
Because if you make mu very big, it somehow seems rather odd. What happens? You know, for mu equals infinity, somehow it can ripple, but it can't.
Well, it's a question of what length scales will come in. In other words, in all these, the length scale, if mu is large, these effects will only set in. If a microscopic unit is large, these effects will only set in beyond certain length scale, which is dependent on that microscopic u.
Yeah, I think what I was partly meaning was even if mu is infinite, dh doesn't have to be zero. It just has to point in one direction. That's probably a pathological limit.
Yeah, okay, so,
you can still ripple it,
right. Right, you just can't ripple in the other direction,
yeah.
Right? And so that's precisely what stabilizes it, even if mu is large. So, okay, so let me just summarize this again. So there's a long-range order in the normals in the flat phase. The main characteristic of this is how the height fluctuations undulate and how it grows. There's actually another parameter, it's how the phonons are undulating, and so I'm not focusing on that at the moment, but given the eta or zeta, the roughness of this membrane, you can calculate everything. So some of the summary of this is, I've already said, let me just come back to this physical issue of the properties of this elastic membrane. I've shown that this membrane is stable to thermal fluctuations, and now I want to interpret it more physically. What is it, you know, what are these fixed point means, and what does this length scale dependent kappas and shear moduli mean? Okay, you have a question? You can think of it that way. I mean, much, much more highbrow. It's sort of a red herring, right? I mean, Neumann-Ragnow theorem is proved in some context of magnetic systems or maybe helium, superfluid. Yeah, okay. I mean, I can just sort of say, okay, it's proved for a particular model. This is a different model, okay? And, there's some more general proofs, I mean, by Coleman, which assume unitarity and, I don't know, some other assumptions. Well, it depends on the.
I think it's important to use defined symmetry.
Is what?
I think the important thing is defined symmetry. Proof internal symmetry. This is not internal symmetry. This is normal with the stuff.
With the in plane.
There's what pretty linear, but anyway, I think it's important to use defined symmetry.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So what you're saying here is that the kinetic energy is changed, right? That the thing in front, the kinetic energy
right.
is squared.
It's no longer q to the fourth. It's
q.
That's right. You can think that it's not q to the fourth. It's q to the fourth minus epsilon eta.
In Coleman's proof, he just does the one thing. He shows that there's
infinite divergence. Right. 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 That's right. I mean, it's basically the argument comes down to 1 over q squared ddq.
Right.
Okay. But if the Goldstone modes are non-trivial, there's some non-trivial fixed point that describes a low temperature phase. That doesn't have to be the case. And the reason you have this non-trivial fixed point, as you pointed out, is that you or Alex pointed out, there's basically this effective long-range interaction if you just focus on these height fluctuations, which is mediated by phonons. That's one way to think of it. So one thing I want to sort of cute... Huh? That's right. So one thing it's amusing is the physical interpretation of this is that if you you know, what is this kappa diverging? It's saying that if I take a membrane that's large and make it larger and larger, kappa grows. So one way to understand, and on the other hand, the shear modulus goes to zero. So one way to understand this, as I like to show, is that if you take a sheet of paper, it has a very small kappa, microscopic kappa, and very large mu. Okay? And now imagine and so it's very easy for it to fluctuate. Okay? On the other hand, suppose I crumple this membrane, well, so as to introduce some thermal fluctuation. So that's a snapshot of the membrane. So now, the membrane is a lot stiffer. And that has to do with shear modulus and fluctuations, because once I have some ripples in the membrane, because of the shear modulus, I can't no longer bend it in the direction, because whatever direction I try to bend it into, I always come across ripples, random ripples that run in perpendicular direction. And that's only possible in the system where you have, first of all, non-trivial two-dimensional topology, or higher dimensional than one. So in polymers, it doesn't happen. And it also relies on the fact that there's a finite shear modulus that, and therefore, it doesn't happen in liquid membranes. So that's one thing. So the kappa is definitely larger. Also, the shear modulus is now a lot, if I look at sort of the effective shear modulus, it's going to zero, because the bigger the system, the bigger the fluctuations, the more I can deform it at the expense of the out-of-plane fluctuations. Finally, one cute thing that comes out of this, and this is a calculation with Pierre Ledussal that I call normal, that we predict that the what's called the Poisson ratio is actually a universal number. It's sort of like amplitude ratio. It's minus a third. And what a Poisson ratio is, for those of you who are not familiar with it, basically a quantity that tells you when you stretch something in one direction, how much does it contract in the other direction. And the fact that you have a negative Poisson ratio that's predicted at this non-trivial fixed point is that it's actually you stretch it in one direction, this membrane will expand in the other direction. Not contract, but expand. And the reason that happens is because when you expand something, you're not really stretching, you're suppressing out-of-plane undulation. And so when I take this object and I expand it, it actually will expand in this direction as well. And the ratio is exactly one-third that we predict. And in fact, there have been some really beautiful, huge simulations by Mark Bowick et al. At Syracuse that verify this fairly precisely. You know, I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but they find wonderful agreement of one minus one-third. First of all, the minus sign is not trivial, and the actual number. And similarly, there's very good agreement with our predictions from the simulation for the roughness of this membrane, or eta. So these guys are basically related. Okay, so what? Okay, so one thing I sort of hard for me to resist from mentioning is that in a real membrane, because something I spent quite a bit of time trying to understand in collaboration with David Nelson and Pierre Ledussal, is in real membranes you really have all kinds of what we would call condensed matter physics dirt, and biologists would really focus on this so-called dirt, and this dirt is important, and so that means that even at zero temperature, if you have this dirt, one way to say it is the preferred conformation of membrane, even at zero temperature, is not flat. And because it's not flat, you might want to even ask at zero temperature, how rough is this membrane in the presence of various types of dirt you can add to it? Various types of topological, or various types of disorder in homogeneities. And so there's a lot of sort of results that come out from it. The upshot is there, please don't read all of it, just focus on these two things. The upshot is if you add disorder, there's analogs of spin glasses that occur in magnetic systems, and there are two types. They come in two types. One is a crumpled kind of a glass, and the other one's a flat kind of glass. Crumpled glass is sort of the analog of the crumpled phase, but it's frozen. And the flat glass is the sort of the analog of the flat phase, but it's frozen, where the normal is frozen, and sort of controlled by a zero temperature fixed point. Okay, and so we spend a lot of time trying to understand the properties of these phases. And in fact, there are some experimental realizations of these disordered objects that have been seen in David Bensimon's laboratory in Paris. Okay, so that's sort of what the upshot of this, what the status of this field was up until maybe until 4 years ago. Okay, and so 4 years ago I was visiting, and so, okay, so let me maybe cover up the bottom line is that, so these are the two phases, this was the upshot of the field about 4 years ago when I was visiting here, and I was giving a talk similar to this one, maybe a little bit more technical, at one of the seminars during the workshop. And Liam Balenz, being the smart guy that he is, during the talk, he asked me, I think I was talking about the flat phase, and so he asked me what would anisotropy do in a flat phase, and The standard answer is actually it doesn't do anything. That is, suppose I put in the bonds in this direction that are stronger than in this direction. It doesn't matter how I put the anisotropy, I just make the x direction different elastically from the y direction. And so I said, well, okay, there's no effect. I can just sort of look at length scales that are in those units, those rescaled units, and that's the standard answer, and there's nothing happens. Actually, what turns out is that I later, after the talk, realized that there was a paper by John Toner who actually asked the same very question, who actually figured out that at this fixed point, not only the anisotropy is not important in this sense that I can just measure scales, length scales in this new unit, but actually weak anisotropy is actually irrelevant. So if you put in some anisotropic operators at that fixed point, it actually flows back to that fixed point. And so from that point of view, the membrane at long scales, even if you have anisotropic bonds, looks isotropic. Okay? So, but nevertheless, sort of my answer basically was, crude answer was to Leon's question was that it's not important. The crumple phases also have no effect. Again, you can rescale length scales. But then after the talk, I started thinking more and more about this, and basically everything I'm going to tell you from now on or at least the first part, the mean field theory part, I figured out in sort of my last 2 days at ITP. And so then I called up John Toner and we started discussing more this, and he got really excited, and then we worked out a lot of what I think is interesting details of the phase. And the new phase that appears, that is, what is the point? While these phases are stable, that doesn't mean that the whole phase diagram is stable. You know, if you look sort of more globally, new phases appear. And the new phase that appears is this tubule phase. And so this phase is what I'm going to focus on. Okay? And so let me try to motivate where this phase appears and what the phase diagram is. So, polymerized membrane, right.
Are they described by totally different theories, or in your theory, whether there's a parameter set to 0 or 2 so that you get back to the liquid membrane?
No, I mean, they're described, basically you can describe liquid membranes by throwing away the phonons, because phonon is not a real degree, statistical, you know, it's not a real degree of freedom anymore. So it's sort of like these liquid membranes are sort of like the string theory, like bosonic string theory, mm-hmm. in that the only degree of freedom is it's, you know, sort of the metric. It doesn't matter how the molecules are arranged on that, you know, they sort of quickly rush to sort of equilibrate within the membrane. And so there's no the soft phonon mode that exists in the elastic mode that exists for the polymerized membrane.
So it's a different theory.
It's different theory, and then you really have to write down sort of, you know, for your background, like this Polyakov bosonic string. You know, that's what it looks like. But it's different theory. You can also ask about these effects, and they're not important, as I try to illustrate by more physical arguments. That basically, if you keep track of the shear modulus and you naively set shear modulus to zero, all these effects go away. Okay. So now, what I want to say is, suppose you have a tube anisotropic system. So now, in principle, you have two order parameters. So this is going to be completely mean field description. There's a Tx, the tangent in the x direction, and tangent in the y direction. And so then, the mean field theory looks like there's some quartic terms in Tx to the fourth, Ty to the fourth. There's some coupling between them. And the most important thing is that the reduced temperature for this guy and this guy doesn't have to be the same. And these guys can change sign independently because now the thing is anisotropic. Once that's the case, you get this beautiful phase diagram that basically says that if tau y is positive, okay, so if tau y and tau x are both positive, you get a crumpled state. And anisotropy is not very important. If tau perp and tau y are both negative, you get a flat phase. But if one of them changes sign and the other one does not, let's say in this region, you get this tubule phase. That is, and what you should think of the tubule is not really a tubule where it's like closed like this topologically, but you should think of it as an object like this which has a cross section which is like a coiled up polymer. So you should think of it as completely disordered in this direction and has a long-range, one-dimensional long-range order in this direction. Okay? And so that's the system where, you know, these order parameters are related to conformation of the membranes like this. These Tx and Ty are related to the conformation of the membrane. So this phase, and therefore you have second-order phase transitions from here to here, from here to here, from tubule to flat, from both sides. Okay. And this type of structure of phase diagram, here you have a tetrachritical point, and this phase diagram only applies when this condition holds. That is, when this uxx times uyy is bigger than uxy squared. There's another topology of a phase of this system, if, just as I mentioned as an aside, is that if the couplings are stronger between the two order parameters, then you actually have you completely squeeze out the flat phase, and you have a first order transition between one tubule and another tubule. That's sort of, I'm not going to focus on that. That's sort of something to keep in mind. Okay, so let me summarize again, just sort of if I went over too quickly. In mean field theory, that is, if you know fluctuations, you simply minimize that free energy for Tx and Ty. There are two order parameters because it's an anisotropic membrane. There's a crumpled phase when Tx and Ty are both zero, and that occurs when tau x, reduced temperatures, are both positive. So you could sort of think of it as a point. Everything collapses to a point. That's the crumpled state without fluctuations. Then there's an intermediate state when tau x is positive, tau y is negative. One of the order parameters is zero, the other is not zero. Everything collapses to a line. That's the tubule phase at zero temperature and no self-avoidance. And finally, there's a flat phase when it's a plane. And the whole point is now to try to ask what happens if you include thermal fluctuations. And so in thermal fluctuations, this point somehow will blow up to some crumpled object. And my goal will be to describe this crumpled object, and that has already been done before. The flat phase will begin to fluctuate, and there will be some roughness of it. And I won't need to know how rough is it, and also what the phonons on the surface are doing. And finally, what the focus of our work was, what this new phase does. How does it respond to fluctuations? And in particular, is it even stable? You know, just like for this phase, I had to ask whether the fluctuations in the flat phase destabilize the flat phase. I have to now ask whether the fluctuations in this phase destabilize it. And so that's really real subtlety. I mean, in mean field theory, you can show anything exists, basically, but you can construct a theory of it. But you need to show that it's stable to fluctuations. So here's my tubule phase, so I need to put in fluctuations. Well, in ground state, the tubule phase configuration is just described by a line. 0, comma, y, comma, 0. This is a tubule phase oriented along the y direction. But in general, it's described by some undulation of hx and hz. That is, these zeros are no longer zero, plus some phonon undulations in this direction. And there are two modes in this direction, in the z direction and the x direction. These are the undulation height mode, and there's a phonon mode. And this is in contrast to the flat phase, where you have two phonons and one height. Okay? So, again, so you now take the full anisotropic theory, which is a big monster, and you look at the low temperature phase, tubule phase. And what you get out is a theory in terms of the phonons and the height undulations. So schematically, I don't want to even that guy is a little bit ugly, so I didn't want to write it down, but schematically, it sort of looks like this. There's one direction that's hard, that is, there's the first derivative, that's the direction that's disordered, and one direction is soft, that's the Goldstone mode. That's the soft direction, that's the y direction, and then there's some interactions which arise if I integrate the phonons out. Okay, so that's sort of one way to do it. Actually, it's a lot neater to keep the phonons in and to work with the phonons, because then you don't get any long-range interactions. And so then you have also self-avoiding interaction. What's one thing that's neat about this phase is...
You told us before not to think of the cross-section as a closed curve.
Yeah, this is a little... Yeah, so that's... I just don't know how to draw...
So you don't...
Well...
Very much so.
Very much so. And I'm sort of, I won't be able to discuss.
So where are the boundary terms?
Well, you don't have to worry about the boundary terms as such, but you have to worry about how you take thermodynamic limit, what aspect ratio of this object is. And if you want, I can, after the talk, I can discuss it. But, so let me gloss over that point for a sec, just because otherwise I won't get the main point across, and this is sort of a little bit more getting you a little bit more technical. So the upshot is that, you know, you need to treat this theory, and there's, again, some non-trivial fixed point that describes it. That is, it tells you how rough this tubule is, how much it's undulating, and how thick it is, okay? How much the self-avoidance and thermal fluctuations swell it.
Did you do the self-avoidance in the previous discussion?
Okay. I'll come back to that. Let me come back to that. Okay, so basically, okay, let me say it now. In the crumpled state, self-avoidance is important. And that's the whole focus. How does the self-avoidance modify crumpled state? Because things collide all the time. In the flat phase, the Cepha ones is not very important because, you know, distant points are very rarely come together. What's beautiful about this state is, and what makes it really challenging and difficult to treat, is that it has a combination of difficulties of both the flat and crumpled state. On one hand, it has anomalous elasticity. And what I mean by anomalous elasticity, just like this flat object is hard to bend when there are undulations. Tubule, there's this coupling between phonons, which is stretching, and undulations. Okay? And on the other hand, which is, that's the physics you have in the flat phase. But on the other hand, you also have the physics of the crumpled state that's, because the one direction is disordered, these guys can contact each other and the self-avoidance is important. So you need to treat this horrendous self-avoiding interaction that you treat in polymers and crumpled state and simultaneously include nonlinear elasticity, which is sort of local interactions. And that has never been done before, sort of in any of the systems that people have studied of this type. One thing that I want to point out is, so the upshot of the studying in this phase is that very much like I described for the flat phase, if you ask how much is this thing undulating, if you take a square membrane and make it go to a tubule phase, the theta undulations will also go as L over A to some negative power due to this, where eta is the same eta, this anomalous elasticity eta. And so this is small at long scales, and therefore we can prove that the state is stable. Let me sort of address some of the issues that people were asking about by taking a little closer look at this. So, you know, this is a little bit maybe, I'm getting a little bit technical. So I sort of was unsatisfied with this talk because I felt it had no, as colloquium sometimes go, or, you know, there's little content sort of beyond review of old stuff and then some mean field theory. So in the last half an hour, I tried to write up something that gives you a little bit more flavor of why it's non-trivial. So in what I'm cheating when I'm giving you this talk, okay, so far at least. So one thing that I've never said is that, you know, you could have asked me, once I have an anisotropic object, these radius of gyration or the how much it undulates, how much the membrane undulates, sorry, I will cover this up just so we focus on this, is that they actually depend both on L perp, the direction that's disordered, and Ly, the direction, how big the membrane is in the Y direction. Normally you say, well, why should I distinguish between those? The naive thermodynamic limit that I'll take will be that L perp is the same as Ly. You know, why would I ever do anything differently? Here, once I have anisotropic membrane, which leads to a very anisotropic state, not just anisotropic in the sense of quantity, quantitatively anisotropic, but in the sense of elasticity, the state is very anisotropic in the sense that in the x direction, in the y direction, it's very soft. In the x direction, it's very hard, so it's infinitely anisotropic. So that is, the length scales in the x direction go a square of the length scales in the y direction. So that is, the bulk modes fluctuate very anisotropically. They're like ellipses with a major axis along the x direction, the disordered direction. So that means I have to actually ask, you know, what really happens in anisotropic, what really happens with the boundaries? If I was asking about correlation functions that are living inside the membrane, some scattering, and asking how much it fluctuates, then I'm okay with just the bulk modes. But if I actually want to know how much is this end fluctuated relative to this end, it's very important who controls those fluctuations. Is it the bulk modes or actually the zero modes? And it turns out, for these quantities, it's very important how to take the thermodynamic limit. And, you know, you can ask about any aspect ratio. So basically what I'm saying is these quantities are actually non-trivial functions of L perp and Ly with some scaling function. So this thing goes as L perp to the nu with some scaling function. And this goes as Ly to some zeta, which is the roughness exponent, because how rough the membrane is, times some scaling function. And so there are actually two independent exponents, eta kappa and nu. And if you can, because z is related to eta kappa and nu, and zeta is related to nu and over z. And so if you can compute these two, then you're all set. Okay. So, and the way eta kappa is defined is basically how much does the kappa grow. Let me just give you a flavor of what am I talking about, this nonsense about different thermodynamic limits. Well, if I take a square membrane, that is L perp goes as Ly, goes as L, goes to infinity, then I recover the result I've been quoting so far, that I haven't been, you know, the result I've been emphasizing, that Rg goes as L to the nu, HRMS goes as L to the 1 minus some anomalies. Because there's this anomaly, HRMS is much smaller than L. So this tubule is undulating along its direction or of ordering, but its undulations, transverse to direction of motion, are much smaller than its size. And because of that, I say the state is stable, as I have asserted in the previous transparency. You might ask, how the hell does it happen that this R of G and its HRMS, which are naively determined by the same correlation function, H squared averaged and H squared averaged, how is it that they scale differently? And the reason that happens is because this quantity turns out to be controlled by the bulk mode, while this quantity is controlled by the zero Q perp equals zero mode. And so because of that, they have very different physics. They have very different behavior. These zero modes are very important. If you don't really think about this anisotropies, which naturally you don't have to think about in the isotropic systems, you will never recover some standard thing that you better recover. For example, if you take a membrane that's very, very thin in one direction and extended in the order direction, you better recover a polymer limit in which you better crumple. So how does that come out? Well, that's all hidden in those scaling functions. For example, let's look at HRMS. It turns out that if you look in this limit, you'll get it goes as Ly times some dimensionless number. The dimensionless number is Ly divided by some persistent length. And that persistent length is L perp dependent. So that is, this is L perp direction, this is Ly. And this persistent length grows as L perp. Not surprising, because the thing is stiffer than the wider I make this band. And so if L perp is the same as Ly equals to L, like here, then this persistent length is much larger than the size of the system. Okay? By precisely this amount. On the other hand, if L perp is not Ly, but bigger, but smaller, then this thing will crumple, and it will be a polymer which will have a polymer bending rigidity which will go as L perp, that is the thickness of this polymer, to the naive power 1 plus some anomaly. Okay? And this anomaly, so we're actually making predictions not only about tubules, but because of fluctuation, we're making predictions about how, if you take a strip that's fluctuating and actually curving on along itself, if it's wide enough, longer than this crossover length scale where these effects take place, its bending rigidity will not just go as the thickness, its bending rigidity in this direction will not just go as the thickness scale with the thickness of the polymer, but actually will scale with a higher power. And that comes from fluctuation. We have also studied all the details of phase transitions from the crumple to tubule to flat phase, where one can compute sort of how the aspect ratio actually evolves from here to here to here as a function of reduced temperature. And also you can predict things about the specific heat. One thing is important that I can't resist to point out is that the tubule phase itself, as long as there's no, if you ignore self-avoidance, we can compute everything exactly. There's enough symmetries in there that we get lucky. Certain nonlinearities become irrelevant near small if they're weak. That we can, unlike the flat phase, we can compute everything exactly. So the real sticking point is to include self-avoiding interaction. And so this is something I've already answered, but I want to just summarize. What makes the tubule so difficult is, again, the following. In the crumpled state, you only have self-avoiding interaction. That's the only important nonlinearity. And so then you're trying to compute this new. In the flat phase, there's this nonlinear elasticity, which is the coupling between the phonons and the height undulations that makes it non-trivial. And that's the only non-trivial nonlinearity. In the tubule phase, you have both of these. Okay? And so the question is to figure out how to treat it. It turns out that the self-avoiding interaction, so you ask, when is the self-avoiding interaction important? It becomes important below 11 dimensions, embedding dimensions, for a two-dimensional sheet. Okay? So then you can, in principle, you can try to calculate how it behaves and what its relevance is and compute everything. But what's beautiful, what turns out that happens is that near 11 dimensions, we can show quite rigorously that elastic nonlinearities of this type are completely irrelevant. And so then you can do a standard epsilon expansion around 11 dimensions. And this was done by Mark Boak and Emmanuel Gittier. However, we also have a rigorous proof that there's some embedding dimension, M star, which approximately equals to 6.5, but has a lower bound of 7/2, which is bigger than 3, that below, if you take an embedding dimension below this, that is physical dimension, let's say 3, this theory has to break down because below that embedding dimension, nonlinear elasticity begins to be important. And so your epsilon expansion actually breaks down, and your exponents actually, when you cross this embedding dimension, actually jump. Okay? And so there's a new non-trivial exponent that appears. And so trying to understand these role of both of these nonlinearities simultaneously is a complicated challenge.
Do you have any intuitive picture about why it's 11? I mean, in the same way that you can intuitively make plausible 4 for self-avoiding
walks? I haven't been able to come up with a satisfactory reason. Okay, so let me just, I'm running a little late, so let me just conclude then. I mean, basically, and maybe I can address this during the questions. So basically what I've discussed is fluctuation physics in polymerized membranes as distinguished from liquid membranes. Some of the phases I've discussed that exist are crumpled phases, where the membrane is completely disordered, a flat phase, where the membrane is completely ordered and fluctuates and has interesting anomalous properties, some glassy phases, and the new intermediate phase that we predicted that exists in these tubules. That exists in these tubules. This, as I hope I've demonstrated, these systems are very rich and can be studied both in experiments and in simulations. The simulations is what I'm saying or know about. The most beautiful picture of this whole talk, which comes from Mark Borg's group at Syracuse, which generated all this excitement recently, is that they've discovered this tubule phase. They actually do, enormous simulations of phantom tubules, which are not self-avoiding, and they actually discover the phase transition from the crumpled phase to a tubule phase to a flat phase that we predicted 3 years ago. And so that's actually why I'm sort of renewed my interest in this. John and I have renewed interest in the system. That's actually our prediction's been verified, and actually quantitatively been verified, in with respect to how much the tubule undulates and how thick is it. Something I didn't mention, these fluctuation effects is a one subclass of much more general subject of elastic manifolds that occur in flux lines, polymers, maybe domain walls. And this subject has an interesting interplay between sort of field theory and statistical mechanics and geometry, and that's what makes it rich. So thanks for your attention. So, are there any questions?
I remember hearing at some point that people claim that there is no crumpled phase.
There's sort of two camps. Let me try to repeat the question. So, when people do simulations of real membranes in which there's self-avoidance, they find that surprisingly, in contrast to expectations, that it's the crumpled phase that's difficult to find, not the flat one. The flat one exists and it's beautiful and it sort of obeys all the results that we predict it should have. But because of self-avoidance, self-avoidance is strong enough that somehow it makes it prevents the disordered phase to exist. And so there are these two camps some believe that it doesn't exist, crumpled phase does not exist. The other camp, to which I belong, that I feel that the crumpled phase does exist, is just, often these simulations are, most of these simulations are very similar. It's very similar code, just a bunch of balls and springs. And it's very easy to convince yourself that if you have self-avoidance, you don't want the balls to go through each other. So you have to make them big enough. Okay? If you make them big enough, then you can create rigidity, effective rigidity between plaquettes. Okay? And so therefore, obviously, by creating the self-avoidance, you're also creating effective bending kappa. Bending rigidity. And so what I believe is basically in these simulations, and there's simulation by Bob Gardner who claims he does find a crumpled phase of plaquettes, not balls. But when you do it with balls, I just believe that you always create a microscopic kappa that puts you on the flat side of the transition. It's always rigid. But even if the crumpled phase does not exist, actually makes the tubule phase even more interesting, because the tubule phase is less disordered. Because it's less disordered, If there's no crumpled phase, that's the only phase then that can compete. You know, that's the only phase that can exist beyond the flat phase. And since it's more ordered, you know, you could argue that maybe self-avoidance is not as effective as destroying it, even if you believe that self-avoidance destroys the crumpled phase. So that's sort of the... I think it's a little bit of a red herring. I mean, okay, I mean, I'll leave it at that. I don't think, you know, asymptotically, if you really took large systems, that you could...
Well, actually, inside the membranes, which are very simple, which are equivalent to sphere, does it make sense that study membranes can handle
strain on them? Not... And people have certainly studied those systems, and in fact, there are experiments that that I've seen in the Colnar now where they actually, you know, study, at least experimentally, you know, topological phase transitions. You know, they can actually create two tori, three tori, and study how they go from one to the other. But that all occurs. That's all physics. The richness of physics of liquid membranes. Here, I sort of once and for all tied all the molecules together, and I don't obviously allow topological changes. Not only I'm not allowing topological changes, I'm not even allowing sort of reperimetrization within the sheet. So, you know, so these are very distinct systems. They have very different behavior, and each one has its own richness.
I just wonder if you start with the section handle.
Right. Here, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Something I've looked at, I'm sure it's going to be handle dependent. I mean, how you put the handle in. I mean, on the scales beyond the handle, it probably won't matter. Right, so you know, if the handle has some size, and you know, I mean, I'm looking at infinite things. Okay, so locally make it more rigid. It's like it'll look like disorder. It locally maybe it'll want to, you know, curve. Yeah.
I hope you don't fit this in the wrong way.
Right? No, I won't. It's okay.
But this is the kind of question I always get when I used to work on biophysics, which is that you have answered a whole bunch of questions that physicists would like answered. Have you answered any questions that biologists would like answered?
I mean, the honest answer is no. And even if, no, I'm not doing, I would never purport that I'm doing biophysics. I would say this physics, this is more doing physics, real physics, statistical mechanics, stimulated just by basic interest in field theoretic things and try to probe them using, and so what I'm doing is really from the other end. I'm trying to do physics and use biological materials as the playing ground, a way to test it. Most of those questions come in the context of liquid membranes, because actually liquid membranes are much more abundant, I didn't mention this, than polymerized membranes. It's actually tough in laboratory to create polymerized membranes. Well, for example, they really want to know, what Alex says, they really want to know about topological phase transition. Why, for example, your erythrocyte all of a sudden has this, goes nuts and creates all kinds of little handles. Not handled, but little sort of...
This is what causes prostate problems?
I've forgotten what the term... do you know what the terminology for that is? I forgot. There's some disease where your blood cell goes from... well, there are various quantities, but, you know, your blood cell is... You know, your blood cell generally has this shape, but sometimes you'll become some kind of object that looks like... You know, it actually grow, and so they want to know why. You know, simple question: why does that happen? Can we understand it from there? Well, we don't know. That's one of the questions. The question is: can you understand it just completely from based on physics? You know, maybe some topological transition, and
rather than some
driven, you know, living effect. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I didn't mention is right. So again, it's really trying to understand physics and use biological materials,
right,
rather than, you know, as a testing ground, as experimental testing ground, not the other way around. At least where I come from, you know, I really know too little about biology to
sure.
to claim this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Any other questions? No. Okay. Thanks.